The following message is brought to you by the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity. To learn more about the Ezra Institute's mission to advance the Lordship of Christ, please visit www.ezrainstitute.ca.
A variety of different issues, and we had an interesting lunch discussion. We're now going to look at something which appears to be one of the biggest obstacles and stumbling blocks for people embracing Christianity, and it's the issue of science and faith. Mm-hmm. Is there a conflict between science and faith?
One of the reasons why this is such a great question, particularly the way you've put it, is that we've already discussed the nature of faith.
Yes.
Our first conversation, we talked about the nature of faith. And so before one ever delves into scientific ideas, one has to ask, what is science and how does it relate to faith?
Sure.
What must be true for science to actually work in practice? You see, science makes some basic assumptions. Let's illustrate some of those.
Sure. Okay.
The most basic assumption in science is the uniformity of nature. So when we do science, which is to use our senses to obtain knowledge about the world, we call it the empirical method or empiricism. When we use our senses to get information about the world, we assume that the present's going to be like the past. We've got in and out of this taxi cab several times, and each time we've assumed that this seat was going to hold us up, that the atoms wouldn't suddenly rejuggle so that we pass through the seat and so forth. We expect the uniformity of nature.
Sure.
And as we expect that, when we look at the world around us, we believe that we can look at a particular instance of a thing, like getting into the cab, and then we can go from there to a generalization that it will always be that way, that when you get inside and sit down on a chair, if the chair is sound, it will hold your weight. That's the inductive method. Now, science depends upon the uniformity of nature and our ability to do induction. Now, the most important question we must ask is, what must be true for that to be a reality in our experience?
Right.
And this goes back to that very early question we asked about what are the preconditions of making human experience intelligible. In order for science to be intelligible to us, we need the provision of uniformity in nature. But a non-Christian worldview or a secular worldview cannot provide the preconditions to make science meaningful. Let me illustrate. You believe right now that your brain is giving you reliable information about the world.
Well, I hope so.
I hope so,
yeah.
Right? We believe that there is validity to our senses examining the world and reaching conclusions about it.
Right.
But we can't prove those things directly.
No.
How do you know your memory is reliable? All knowledge and science depends upon the reliability of memory. This expectation of uniformity and continuity is something that must hold true. But David Hume, very famous Scottish empiricist, who was looking at this whole question of science and empiricism, in the end came to the conclusion that because in science we are describing what's going to happen, things that we have never observed, we are doing metaphysics, that is, we are doing philosophy, not science.
Yes.
So one of the key things that we've asked ourselves, particularly in the last century, is what is the philosophy that must undergird science? Science has nothing absolute about it in the sense that we know we're reaching concrete conclusions. We are, for example, if I said all swans are white.
Right.
Because all the swans I've ever seen
are white.
Are white.
Yes.
What needs to happen to pull down my entire theory, my entire hypothesis? All I need to see one day is a black swan fly in amongst the white ones, and my theory's been pulled down. So science isn't absolute. It always has to be tentative.
Sure.
And all the very apparatus of science depends upon believing certain things. Now, if you're not a believer, if you're not a Christian, if you're a skeptic, that is, if you believe in the end in that the universe is chance, matter in motion, chaos, that's how it originated, then you actually believe that everything is atoms.
Yes.
You believe in brain, but you don't believe in mind. Mind is not brain. But doing science presupposes that you have a mind to reason with, that you can actually use logic, which are immaterial, abstract ideas like numbers. You know, if I can't hold the number three, threeness is an abstract idea.
Okay.
Laws of logic are abstract, they're not material. Using reason in science, us reasoning together today, is not something that is material, it's not matter in motion. If that was so, then there couldn't be valid science or invalid science, because there wouldn't be any. Who's to say that my atomic accident of my brain and the atomic accident of your brain are valid or invalid? That must be judged on the basis of some immaterial law of logic. So science rests upon these assumptions that can only be grounded in the Christian worldview. That is why modern science arose in the lap of Christianity post-Reformation, when if God can be known, his works can be known. And because he's a God of order and rationality, we can discover things about the world. So the likes of Isaac Newton and Kepler and Pascal and many of the fathers of modern science were Bible-believing Christians, because they believed our minds gave us reliable information about the world. Reason, logic, math, language are all valid because there is a God. Without God, we can't justify doing science.
But why is so much science taught in schools? Like my sons, they come back and tell me what they've been taught. It's taught, the theories of science are often taught as fact and are anti-faith. Mm-hmm. Well, why is that?
Well, it's just bad science and bad teaching. Because anybody who knows really anything about the philosophy of science, and you only have to go and read Karl Popper and others like this, not Christians, who unpack the philosophy of science, is that our conclusions are on three levels. Low probability, we call a hypothesis. It's an idea. We've not got much supporting evidence. Theory, we think, is a moderate probability. And a law, we believe, is high probability. So all of science is, at best, only probable in terms of our conclusions about things that we observe. And the assumptions that underlie that are faith assumptions. So in other words, faith always precedes science. You've got to have some faith. Now the question is, does your faith justify you doing science or not? That's the question. The Christian faith justifies you doing science. The materialism or naturalism and pantheism, the only alternate worldviews, do not justify doing science. They cannot justify it, even though you may practice it. So when a teacher tells a school kid, your children or my children at school, that this is a fact, this is certain, we know this is true, it's simply false.
But they, for example, they teach evolution as a fact, but actually it's only a theory.
Well, it's a hypothesis. It doesn't really qualify as a scientific theory.
And what do you mean by hypothesis?
A hypothesis is something that has a very low probability of actually being true.
When people say evolutionary theory, what do they mean?
Okay, the basic ideas of evolutionism are grounded in a faith philosophy, a philosophy of life. That philosophy dates back thousands of years, right back to the ancient Greeks and back to the ancient Babylonians. But there was, of course, Charles Darwin, borrowing ideas from his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, and other scientists. In fact, a Christian creationist called Edward Blyth, a contemporary of Charles Darwin, preceded pretty much all Darwin's observations in terms of variation, natural selection, but he was a special creationist. We all observe that there is variation within species and that species adapt according to their environment within a specific type. What Blyth denied and what creationists deny is that we see those types crossing over one another, that a type ever transcends the boundary. For example, a dog never becomes something else other than a dog. So evolutionary theory is grounded in a faith that things created themselves. That starts with the idea of the Big Bang. The idea that there was this infinite point of density, compressed into a point smaller than an electron, a pinhead.
Sure.
That somehow exploded by powers and means unknown, and that then as it expanded, various gases were formed and particles and so on and so forth. Very complicated math.
Yes.
Very complicated theorizing.
But as you said it as an idea.
It's an idea.
Even scientists today question that.
In New Scientist this year, a letter came into New Scientist from 33 PhD holding scientists. Article called Bucking the Big Bang, in which they were saying we simply cannot accept the evidence for a Big Bang because of what they called fudge factors, which was these sort of just so hypothetical entities that keep having to be introduced to make the theory work, such as inflation, dark matter, various things that physicists understand. The math doesn't work for the Big Bang. We know the math doesn't work. It becomes so involved and complicated because it rests on some Einsteinian laws of relativity. The math doesn't work. The universe is way too big. Even if the universe has been expanding at the speed of light, is the assumption, the universe is far, far too big, what we observe today. Even if it had been from, say, 13.7 billion years ago when the universe was supposed to have been formed, if it's been traveling at the speed of light since then, it would be only 27.4 billion light years wide, but instead we observe that it's more like 156 billion.
Yeah.
In other words, light must have been traveling much, much faster in the past. So we've got, during that period of creation, which I know we're going to talk about shortly,
yeah,
something pretty strange was happening that science can't account for, even with our best hypotheses like the Big Bang. So there are so many problems with it that many scientists are rejecting it. Density of matter, planets, distribution of galaxies, so many different things that could be said.
But it's still taught as fact in schools today.
Well, and it's infuriating.
Well, it is infuriating. Why, if that's a fallacy, why isn't that presented as a fallacy?
Well, because we are dealing with belief systems. It's a philosophy. It's a faith about the world. That's stage one. Stage two is that not only did the universe create itself, things come from nothing, but then actually life comes from non-life. And you've got this idea that actually Louis Pasteur thought that he demonstrated, in fact did demonstrate, was a pure mythology, has been reintroduced again. The idea that lifeless chemicals can form themselves into the basic molecules and foundations of life. And we know experimentally and empirically that there is not even an imaginary path scientifically from lifeless chemicals to living things. Then there's the belief that these single-celled organisms, and of course a cell is incredibly complex.
Yes.
Darwin knew nothing of genetics. Even before you can talk about natural selection, you need something to select from. So this irreducibly complex system is then supposed to be able to produce all of life that we see from some sort of prebiotic compound, that is, some sort of sludge, you know, right through to philosophers today.
So, Joe, just wait a minute. Just explain that.
Basically, it means that given structures in nature, within the biological system of the human body, for example, if you reduce them at all in their constituent parts, if you took pieces away, they wouldn't work. In other words, all the pieces have to be in place in order for the thing not to be useless. This is true of something in the cells called the flagellum motor, which is something that a scientist called Dr. Michael Behe studied. Another illustration would be the eye.
Yeah.
The numerous components of the eye, if they're not there and functioning correctly, then the eye would be useless and therefore wouldn't possibly be selected. Take our sexual organs. What good is a part-functioning sexual organ if it's no good for reproduction? So the problem is there are absurdities built into the evolutionary system.
Some scientists, Joe, would say that fossils support evolutionary theory.
Interestingly, John, quite the contrary. And this is the remarkable thing, is that you could go to any natural history museum in the world today, and if you were to ask the senior paleontologist there, somebody who studies fossils, to give you an illustration of a series of fossils which show the change of one basic type into another, they wouldn't be able to do it. The former senior paleontologist of the Natural History Museum in London, Dr. Colin Patterson, has admitted in a letter to a guy called Luther Sutherland, who wrote a book called Darwin's Enigma, he admitted that he couldn't even find one fossil which he could argue convincingly. He couldn't make a watertight argument that it was transitional. In other words, what evolution requires is millions and millions and millions of transitional fossils that would show how one creature has gradually become another different basic type. For example, the idea that a land mammal became aquatic and became the whales that we have today.
Sure.
Yet the earliest whales in the fossil record were fully aquatic. They already lived in the sea.
Yes.
So what the fossil record shows resoundingly, which Darwin admitted himself and recognized that it was a major problem, is it doesn't show this fine gradation of change. In fact, there are a handful of disputed transitional forms. If this were a scientific truth about reality, about the origin of humankind, there should be fossils out. You should be kicking them around in your back garden, showing transitional types. So actually, a theory was proposed back in the 70s by a very noted evolutionist in the States called Stephen Jay Gould, who proposed what he called punctuated equilibrium. It simply means this. Evolution must have rapidly sped up in very isolated areas, so quickly, in fact, that it didn't leave any evidence of itself. And so there are apparently what looked like great leaps in the fossil record. And what he did as a paleontologist was basically expose the fact that we do not have the transitional forms and came up with this, frankly, fudge theory, which has been dubbed the fluky monster theory, which says, oh, well, we don't have any evidence because it just all sped up in these very isolated areas. So actually, the fossil record is one of the biggest disproofs of evolutionary theory. So it's a belief system, it's an entrenched dogma that has to be challenged. The reason it's still taught in school is because it's a religion.
Yes.
It's a religious belief.
Yes.
And we're constantly told, keep religion out of schools. Don't mix religion and science. But science rests upon faith. Yeah. There is no science without faith. The question is, which faith have you got, and can it justify your science? And that is why I believe many of the greatest scientists in history were Christian theists.
Like people like who?
People like Isaac Newton. People like Blaise Pascal, people like Louis Pasteur, Maxwell, Joule's Law. There were numerous scientists in our history, Michael Faraday, who believed, Robert Boyle, they keep coming into my mind, who actually believed in the truth of Christian theism and taught it.
Let's go, mate.
Joe,
let's just go back to the Bible, okay? It says that God created the world in 6 days. Now, does that mean 6 times 24 hours?
Well, if we're going to take the Bible seriously, and we're going to take what the meaning of the text seriously, rather than reading in our external philosophical ideas from the present, if we look at the text does seem to indicate quite clearly, with the Hebrew word yom being bracketed with a number, that it does mean a ordinary earth rotation day with respect to God's creative activity during that first week.
Right, but according to the Bible, history is just a couple of thousand years old. Is that correct?
History would be somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 years, yes, according to a biblical chronology. History as we understand it and know it now.
Okay, but some scientists believe that the world, the universe, the cosmos is millions of years old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, how do you hold both views? And how do the dinosaurs fit into this whole concept?
Okay, let's take the first part first. When we look at the world, and we look at fossils, when we look at fossils of dinosaurs, when we look at the rocks, facts do not speak for themselves. I've never heard a rock speak, you probably haven't.
No.
I haven't heard a dinosaur speak. We have to take the facts at our disposal, or the data, and then we have to interpret it in the light of a theory. So, some cosmologists, they look into the heavens through the telescopes and they look at the data and they interpret it in the light of a particular theory of the cosmos. If you've got a naturalistic worldview, that is, if you're wearing spectacles that make you look at reality that says it's just matter in motion, most gravitate towards Big Bang Theory, although, as we've said, there's a lot of dissension about the Big Bang at the moment and about how the universe itself came about. Scientists do disagree. They have differing hypotheses, different theories, but they all look at the data and then they say, how do we interpret this? We must read it in the light of a particular theory about reality. Now, when a Christian looks at the world, when I look at the world, I see it in the light of the revelation of God in Scripture. I look at it with spectacles on, the spectacles of Scripture. And I say, how do I understand this data, these facts, that lovely little squirrel running there, the fossils, how do I understand these things in the light of a theory or a view of reality?
Yes.
And I understand them in accordance with the Scriptures. That is my frame of reference for understanding reality. So, when we look at the creation account, what we see is God at the beginning, the very beginning of time, bringing time, matter, space and time into existence.
Yeah.
Now, even those who don't believe in God do believe that the known laws of physics that we have today simply cannot apply at the very beginning of the universe. We don't know what was happening. We don't know what processes were going on.
Sure. Yes.
So we do find, looking at the world, we find some strange paradoxes. We talked about one in the cab. The speed of light, for example. Has it really been a constant? Well, the size of the universe would seem to suggest to us now that it can't have been. It must have been traveling faster in the past. One particular scientist, for example, a guy called Dr. Russell Humphreys, proposed the idea that the universe blew up in a sense like you were blown up a beach ball. The universe expanding from a single point with the Earth set in it forms a gravity well. Now, in a gravity well, because of the sheer size of the universe, it is theoretically possible that time is traveling very slow down in the gravity well where the Earth is, whilst on the exterior of the universe, time is passing very quickly. So both light and time can be warped, and that's an idea in theoretical physics.
But how, you know, carbon dating, Joe, and radiometric dating, how valid are those?
Well, I mean, here's a stone down here. We can look at a rock like that.
Yes.
Is there a method by which we can know the age of this stone? It doesn't speak, obviously.
No.
So there is no known method by which we simply put this in a tray and get its age. What we do is we can analyze the half-life by which a parent element decays into another element.
Yes.
And by measuring that, we then make certain assumptions. We assume that the decay rate has been a constant. We have to assume that there has been no contamination, that there's been no water ingress, that hasn't been altered at all. And we have to assume about the original amount of the parent element that was in the rock. And by that, we can calculate a rough age. The key assumption that we have to make, though, that is problematic, particularly problematic, it would seem, is the assumption that decay rates, whether it be uranium to lead, which is one classic example, or carbon-14, have not necessarily always been a constant. And this was shown by a recent study that was done of some of the Earth's basement crystals, zircons, looking at the rate at which helium is released from these zircons. And what was found was a contradiction between the uranium to lead and the helium, amount of helium that was getting out in this in that period of time. This contradiction has led a group of scientists to conclude that actually the decay rates from uranium to lead must have been much, much faster in the past. So we've got a similar illustration. Have the processes that we see going on now always been going on at the same rate as they are in the present? That's an assumption, that's a belief, and unfortunately we can't establish that. In fact, the evidence seems to show, because of these paradoxes and contradictions, that certain processes were taking place much faster in the past than they are today. You've mentioned the dating called carbon dating with respect to carbon-14, and actually almost all the known examples of biota that we have, virtually all of it still contains C14. This is a major problem. It should have dissipated, decayed a long time ago.
Right.
So that's still a problem. In other words, when you look at these things collectively, the processes and laws that we see in operation today can't have been those that brought the universe into existence, yes, and were going on during the creation week. And that's why we find these paradoxes. It's not that the scientists are cheating, trying to make up the data, although sometimes there is dishonesty to try and massage things to fit.
Yep.
The reality is we are dealing with some paradoxes because of both at the beginning of time and at the end of time, God is acting in a transcendent way into this universe that
sure,
we know.
Sure.
So we have to grapple with these paradoxes and problems, and certainly there is much work still to be done.
There is, isn't there? Now, obviously, we're just walking amongst model dinosaurs. How do the real dinosaurs fit into this big picture?
Obviously, a lot of guesswork is involved with dinosaurs. I mean, you know, walking with dinosaurs was a little bit of make-believe science. We have to ask the question, how do we interpret dinosaur fossil evidence that we find in the fossil record? It doesn't speak for itself. We have to interpret it. Within the biblical worldview, within the biblical understanding of reality, these creatures were created with all the other animals during creation week, and because the fossil record is a history of extinction, they died out during the flood and after the global flood recorded in the book of Genesis. So there are creatures today that if they were extinct, like crocodiles, alligators, certain giant yes, turtles, that if we'd found them in the fossil record, we might identify them as dinosaurs. So we have to get our science not from Jurassic Park, but actually from taking a serious look at how we interpret the data we see as best as we possibly can. And the framework for understanding dinosaurs within yep, the Christian worldview is the scripture. In fact, you can read a brilliant description of a dinosaur in the book of Job,
yes,
the Leviathan.
Yes. So let's conclude this section then, Joe, with the question that I posed to you at the beginning. Is there a conflict, any conflict between science and faith?
Clearly there is a conflict between the opinions of some scientists and the faith of Christians. But what we're really dealing with is a conflict between two worldviews. And both of those worldviews have a science of their own.
Yes.
They both have a science, but both have a faith as a foundation. So is there a conflict strictly between science and faith? No. Faith must always be the foundation of science. We must all believe certain things before we can even speak of science. There is a conflict of worldviews. There are two basic kinds of science. One is theistic science, looking through the eyes of the scriptures, presupposing God. There is non-theistic or atheistic science, which looks at the universe as self-created matter in motion. Only one of those worldviews can account for science. My favorite Christian philosopher said, everybody counts, not everybody can account for counting. Within the Christian worldview, we can have reason, we can have logic, we can have maths, we can have human dignity, we can have morality, we can have meaningful language, but specifically those that relate to science. We can have them because we have a God of rationality, a God of order, not of chaos, and those immaterial things like reason and logic can be retained because this world is ultimately spiritual. Because God is spirit, and so there is mind and matter. There is unity in diversity because of the triune God of Scripture.
Who's your favourite philosopher?
Cornelius Van Til.
You've given us a lot to think about, Joe. Very stimulating. Thanks very much.
It's been fun, mate. Thank you.
It's good.
Thank you for listening to this message brought to you by the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity. Please feel free to share it with friends, but do not charge for or alter the material in any way without the express written consent of the EICC. Thank you.